Nathan Fraser Show, episode 112, Nationalism versus Globalism. All right, here we go.
Mixing business with politics. This is the Nathan Fraser Show.
What is up, Free Market Squad? In the place to be, it's your boy Nathan Fraser, High Priest of Propaganda. Thank you for taking a half hour out of your day, out of your week to hang with me. And this week, we're going to be, like I always do, I'm going to be alienating a bunch of my audience. It seems like I only do an episode when I know I can turn off half of my audience, and that's definitely what is going to be happening tonight. Will you still be a loyal listener after tonight's episode? You'll have to stick around and see. It'll be a surprise for both of us. This week, we're going to be talking about nationalism versus globalism. And the reason why I'm talking about this is because recently Donald Trump made this statement. He said, I know it's a dirty word. We're not supposed to use the word anymore, but I'm a nationalist, he said. And his audience went nuts. They were like, yeah, nationalism. And then the media went nuts and they were like, no, nationalism. And we're going to be talking about nationalism, globalism, what it means. And we're going to be approaching both ideas from a bunch of different lenses, and we'll just jump into it. So let's just jump into it. Let's do that. Why is everybody freaking out about Donald Trump saying he's a nationalist? Well, I think the biggest reason why is because, especially in the minds of CNN watchers and MSNBC watchers, it's a very logical jump from nationalist to white nationalist. In fact, the two are almost the same, because everything Donald Trump says is a secret racist dog whistle. So if he's saying he's a nationalist, obviously he's you know, with a grin and a wink, he's saying I'm a white nationalist, orange nationalist, I think would be more accurate. Now, does nationalism mean that you're a white nationalist? Or does it just mean that you're anti-globalist, which is what a lot of people who cheered when Donald Trump said he was a nationalist, a lot of them would consider themselves to be, or proclaim themselves to be, anti-globalists. And people say that being anti-globalist is actually also a secret dog whistle. If you're anti-globalist, what you're actually anti is anti-Semitic. Let's talk about this. So what is nationalism, first of all? And I'm going to start off by saying I'm neither a nationalist or a globalist, but by the end of this episode, you might think that I lean towards globalism. But I'm definitely not a nationalist. But that doesn't mean I oppose nationalism, or I hate nationalists, or I think that nationalists are white nationalists, or that I think the two are one. Really, you know, I'm not even going to jump into my own thoughts on that yet, as far as what nationalism is or why I'm not a nationalist, but I will talk about the definition of nationalism. And nationalism is basically like patriotism. It's pride in one's nation. And it's the idea that you think your nation is superior to other nations. And when I was a kid growing up, that wasn't like a crazy idea. I mean, USA is number one. That was a very common thing for people to cheer. USA, USA, we're number one. That was, that was the thing that I was indoctrinated as a kid. So wanting to put your nation first, wanting to have a president that puts your nation first, as a community, wanting to put your community first, saying we should take care of our own community before we try healing the problems of the entire world, I'm not really against people feeling that way. I can understand why people would feel that way. I can understand why people would care more about their local community on a global level than the entire global community. I can't really hate on people. I don't 100% agree with it, but I can't really hate on people for that, for feeling that way. So, do I think nationalism is racism? Do I think it's white nationalism? Absolutely not. Do I think nationalism is something bad? I'm not a big fan of dividing people up by We're Team USA and we're Team Canada and we're Team whatever, whatever. But I mean, it's tribalism. It's what people do. And I've learned to accept that that's just the way most people see the world. And for however many thousands of years, that's the way the politicians encouraged people to see the world. And now all of a sudden, politicians have done an about face, and they're promoting something called globalism now. Now, what is globalism? Globalism is the idea that diversity is our strength, and that we're all one giant global village, and we need to stop thinking of ourselves as independent nations, sovereign nations. We need to start thinking of ourselves as individual members of a larger global community. And I'm going to talk about how both politicians and corporations, or the leaders of corporations, how they view globalism and why they're tending to lean towards globalism. Why the people that run the world, after so many years of pushing nationalism and pushing the idea of breaking up communities and us against them based off of nation states, why that's falling out of favor and why globalism is falling into favor with the people that basically run the world. No, that is not a racist dog whistle for Jews. Here's the deal. If you're a politician, there's a couple of different reasons why you would, especially at this point in time, why you would be leaning more towards globalism than nationalism. One of the biggest reasons is if you're one of the central bankers, or if you're one of the politicians that's pushing towards all of this globalist rhetoric, globalist legal system, globalist whatever. If you're one of these people, it's because for them, there's a couple of reasons. Number one, they are basically, they're like those guys that get up on stage and they've got like 10 different polls, and there's a bunch of them. There's like five of them. Let's say three of them are international bankers and two of them are international politicians. And they're up on stage and they've got 10 different plates, or maybe 30 different plates, or 40 different plates. And they've got these poles that they're standing the plates on. So there's these poles up on stage. They've got these plates balanced on the poles, and they have to be spinning the plates in order to keep them balanced on the poles. And right now they're running from plate to plate. So they spin the United States plate for a minute, and then they run over and they spin the Canada plate for a minute. And then they run over and they spin the Brazilian plate for a minute. And then they run over and they spin the Germany plate for a minute. And then they run over and so there's these five different guys running around spinning these 30 different plates, trying to keep them all spinning. And it's wasting a lot of energy. And they think to themselves, this would be a lot easier if we could just melt all of these plates down into one giant plate. And then we could have just one pole in the center. And we put this plate on the one pole and we'll all just stand around this plate. We'll stand a fifth of the plate apart, and we'll just all sit there and we'll just spin it with one hand. We won't have to run around. We won't have to exert all of that energy. We've got one plate. We don't have 30 plates to worry about. And we just spin this one plate. It'll be so much easier on us. Life will be so much easier for us, the ruling elite. That's one big reason why they want to push the idea of globalism rather than nationalism now. Because nationalism equals trying to keep 30, 40, 50 plates spinning all at once. Globalism means that they can all just kick back, completely reduce the amount of effort that they're putting into it, and just have one plate to spin. The other reason why is because, at least in the West, in Western democracies, as they say, Western republics, we have a tendency to be more individualistic. We have a tendency to be less communal based, or less collectivist, I guess is the best word. Western values, Western civilization, the Western legal system has put an emphasis on the individual rights, the sovereignty of the individual. And that has created a system where the politicians are kept in check more rigorously than other systems in the world. Politicians in the West can be voted out of power. They can be tarred and feathered, not literally, but they can be tarred and feathered figuratively in the media. You have freedom of speech to say whatever you want about our politicians. Our politicians can lose their power. Our politicians have major restraints on their power. We have systems where there's checks and balances to idealistically keep their power in check. Whether that works or not is debatable, but it works better than most of the other systems throughout the world. Now, most third world countries are ruled by tin pot dictators, and the people that live in those third world countries are used to living under tin pot dictators. They're not used to individual liberties. They're not used to individual rights. They're not used to individuality. They're used to taking orders. They're used to living under authoritarian rule. Now, if you have a population full of people that are not used to that, that by their very nature oppose and despise and reject that type of rulership, and you're a ruler over that type of nation, and you look and you see how these tin pot dictators that exercise authoritarianism over their populations, you look and see how good that they have it, well, of course you're going to be jealous of that. Of course you're going to say, hey, those guys over there in those highly oppressive societies, they've got a good thing going. Maybe we should take a few hints or clues from the way that they're running stuff. Well, the problem is they've got a population, us, the Western world, we're not very keen to that. So one way to kind of move us towards that is to import a bunch of people from those authoritarian nation states and say, hey, you guys are used to authoritarianism anyways, come flood our country, come move over to our country. We'll set you up on welfare. We'll give you free housing. We'll take care of all of your needs. And all you have to do is vote for more authoritarianism. And that's what you're used to anyways. So why would politicians want to bring in or globally mix all of these third world nations and third world populations into their own populations? Because it makes it easier for them to do their job. If they import a large segment of the voting class that comes directly from authoritarian, despotic societies, those people are more apt and more likely to vote for more authoritarian and despotic systems in the traditionally free Western civilization or Western society. So there's a couple of different reasons why politicians would want to do this. Also, if you're a politician, if you're somebody that believes in state power, if you believe that the state is the be-all, end-all to solve social problems, if you're somebody that says, hey, every social problem, the best way to handle it is with the gun of the government, you're someone who's naturally inclined to using government to solve problems. Well, there are global problems. And as a society, as a global society that we are rapidly becoming, especially with the invention of the internet, there are global problems. There are global situations that require global solutions. And so if you're somebody like a politician who believes that other politicians and politicians like yourself are the people best suited to solve problems, and you start seeing these global problems pop up, of course, your first go-to answer is going to be, well, let's start a global government. We've got global problems now. We need a global government. And so things like the UN, things like the European Union, these are not, it's not something that would require a conspiracy theory to think that these things were planned out in advance. You just have to know how people think. Of course, statists are going to state. And if they see a global problem, their first reaction is going to say, well, we need a global government. It's not really a conspiracy theory. It's just being honest about people's motives and being honest about the way people think and the way people problem solve and carrying it out to its logical conclusion. So there are a lot of reasons why politicians, especially now, are leaning more towards globalism than towards nationalism. Now, why are corporations starting to also, I mean, obviously, if it was just the politicians, they wouldn't get too very, or they wouldn't get too far, but they've got all of the global media, or all of the corporate media seems to be, that might have been a Freudian slip, all of the corporate media now seems to be global media. It seems like all of the corporations are covering for all of these globalist politicians. And when a nationalist politician comes out and says, well, I'm a nationalist, of course the global corporations that, you know, the multinational corporations that are running these news agencies, of course they're going to be against that politician, because these globalist corporations, they like globalism as well. So why do these giant corporations, these multinational corporations, what are some of their reasons for liking globalism? And I'm going to say this, as somebody who owns a corporation, I'm actually sympathetic to some of these points of view. So as somebody who is a rugged individualist, as somebody who grew up in the Western civilization and being the benefactor of this, here's the deal. I love capitalism. I love the values of Western civilization that made this system possible. I'm not keen on everything. I don't like how our monetary system works. I don't like central bankers. Even though we have one of the least abusive governments in the world, I still think we have an overpowered, overly abusive government. Yes, there are flaws to our culture. Yes, there are flaws to our organization of society, but I feel fortunate that I was born into it, because this is the reality of the situation. I was born dirt poor. I grew up on welfare. I grew up on Section 8. I grew up on public housing and food stamps and free lunches and, homeless for 3 years, 3.5 years of my childhood, and homeless again for large parts of my teenage years. And I was able to come from that and able to become a successful twice over business owner, failed business owner 3 times before that. I'm okay with admitting that, but now I own 2 successful profitable businesses. I have a pretty steady stream of both passive and active income coming in. And I have, things that kings 100 years ago would have never imagined being able to have, I have as things that I take for granted. So the economic mobility of our civilization, of our culture, of our legal system, the economic mobility that we have allowed me to go from being a dirt poor child, one of 4 children born to a welfare mom, allowed me to go from that to being a quasi-successful business owner who doesn't really want for anything anymore. Growing up hungry to being to the point now where I don't ever even have to look at the price on a menu when I'm trying to decide what I want to eat. Like, that's a vast difference. And it wouldn't have been possible for me to go from the class I was born into the class that I'm now, living as a reality, if it wasn't for Western civilization and capitalism and individual values that most of us really don't take the time to appreciate. So I'm a capitalist. I'm okay with that. I'm okay with admitting that. I'm also a business owner. So, I sympathize with nationalists, but I also sympathize with globalists, because as a business owner, this is the reality of the situation. I'm not a big fan of nations. I'm not a big fan of different types of rules for different types of nations. I'm not a big fan of the European Union collecting a VAT tax and the United States not collecting a VAT tax. I'm not a big fan of, if I'm going to do business here, I have to worry about all of these different rules. And it's getting even worse now. It's getting to the point now where even inside of the United States, different states want to tax things at different rates. And if you own a business where you sell just within the United States, it's getting to the point where you have to know one set of tax laws for Utah, a different set of tax laws for for Colorado, a different set of tax laws for California. And depending on where you're selling, you have to, I mean, Amazon, a few years back, one of the things that they did was they were just like, okay, four or five different states, we're just not going to allow people to become affiliates in. And because every single state taxes things differently, it makes it very hard to do business over state lines. And now all of the different states are wanting to actually start to collect sales tax and income tax on sales that you make in their state. And man, to do all of that is, I mean, I'm trying to run a business. I'm worried about marketing. I'm worried about inventory. I'm worried about making sure that my servers stay up. I'm worried about security. I'm worried about protecting my customers and clients. I'm worried about making sure that they get what they're paying me for. I've got all these things to worry about. And now I've got to worry about 50 different sets of tax laws and 50 different sets of regulations, because every single state has different regulations and different tax codes and all of that stuff. Like, as a business owner, I'm just like, I really wish that somebody would just streamline this and I would only have to hire an accountant to worry about one set of rules. And as a business owner that sells to people in Europe, that does business with people in Europe, does business with people in Canada, does business with people in South America, as somebody who's doing business with people globally and having to deal with the frustrations of, well, if I charge you this over here, I'm going to have to also include this tax, and I'm going to have to also include this service fee. And if I sell it in one state, it's sold like this, but if I sell it in a different state, I mean, Chicago just recently added an additional tax to PlayStation. When you buy games on PlayStation or when you buy downloadable content on PlayStation, you have to pay an additional tax. It's like a frivolous, well, all taxes are frivolous. It's like an entertainment tax, basically. And throughout the rest of the state of Illinois, there's not the tax, but inside the city limits of Chicago, there is the tax. So, and PlayStation has to stay on top of that. Their accountants have to stay on top of that. And so, as a business owner, having a million different tax laws and a million different regulatory rules that I have to stay in compliance with, it makes it to where I almost don't want to do business. And it makes it to where I'd say, you know what? I'd rather just have one universal tax law. I'd rather have just one governing body for all of the taxes so that I wouldn't have to pay an accountant to know 50 different jurisdictions or 1,000 different jurisdictions and 1,000 different regulations and 1,000 different tax law compliance rules and all of this stuff. As a business owner who does business globally, I would prefer to have a global set of standards. Now, does that mean that I want a global government? Absolutely not. The reason why I like sovereign national governments is if this government gets too crazy, I can escape and I can go live in a different government. If our government starts to go more socialist than it already is, I want to be able to escape. I want to be able to move my business to a more business-friendly environment. I want to be able to pick up and relocate myself to a society that respects individuals more than the United States stuff does, if it gets to the point where I feel like the United States doesn't do it enough. I don't want a global government. I don't want a situation where if I don't like what the government is doing, there's nowhere to go because that same government rules the entire world. I don't want a global government, but as a business owner, I can see why the idea is attractive. I can see why it's appealing. I can see why other businesses out there or other business owners or other CEOs or corporate boards, I can see why they would want a uniform set of rules so that it doesn't make it so frustrating to do business internationally. Now, here's the thing. As a business owner, I like having the ability to hire a virtual assistant out of the Philippines. I like having the ability to hire a programmer that doesn't live in the United States because I can get the same quality of work for even cheaper. I'm even not completely against sweatshops, to be honest. I mean, here's the deal. If I'm able to get something for cheaper and charge less for it to get it to you, I can see why people adopt the drop shipping mentality or the drop shipping business model. because they're able to get things for super cheap. They're able to get it into the hands of the customer. And while I'm not completely keen on the way that those businesses usually treat their employees, I'm going to say actually I'm opposed to the way a lot of those businesses treat their employees. The fact of the matter is that the employees that are working there, it's usually they have the choice between that or digging through garbage piles for food. Like a lot of these nations where sweatshops pop up, they have no sense of capitalism, and capitalism brings those countries out of the depression that they're in. It industrializes, it brings them up to living standards of the rest of the world. And so if they're living in a nation or an area where they don't have any industry, and somebody comes in and they create a system where, like, hey, you get paid 13 cents a day, but that's 13 cents more than any other opportunity where you're at right now. Well, the next sweatshop that comes in has to pay 14 cents a day. The next one that comes in after that has to pay 16 cents a day. And what that has an effect of doing is takes people from a society where they're digging through trash to stay alive to a society where they're working and they're just barely getting by, to a society where they're working and they're having a more a stronger and stronger economy. And eventually, if it goes, it takes a natural route that it has to go. It can't go from 0 to 60 in overnight, but eventually it does get to 60. Eventually it does catch up with the rest of the industrialized world. That's only possible by business owners who quote unquote exploit the third world. That's the only way that it, in my opinion, is possible. You can say, oh, well, we could just send money to those people and subsidize them or send money to them in relief aid. Well, there's, a slight divergence. The fact is, if I'm a farmer in those countries and the United States starts sending aid, starts sending food, dropping boxes of food, well, if people can get free food, why are they going to buy my farming food? And if they're going to stop buying the food that I farm, why am I going to keep farming? And so I quit my farm, and all the other local farmers quit their farms as well. And now when the United States decides that they're going to stop dropping boxes of aid, there's no more farms. So if we say, well, instead of letting countries go from undeveloped to developed at the natural process of introducing capitalism to them, we should just send them free aid. I'm not sure that I think that free aid is really the solution. I think I'm going to have to say, from my limited understanding of things, letting them get there naturally by introducing sweatshops and then moving on to, more and more pay eventually, to where eventually they get to the point. Yeah, it's a slow process, but it's actually healthier than creating dependence and creating more dependence, because all the farmers and all the actual producers say, well, it's not worth it to do it because it's better just to get the aid. You get where I'm going with this, or hopefully you do. Otherwise, I totally just wasted the last couple of minutes of your life, and I apologize for that. But that's my thing. Here's the way I feel. Money should just be a medium of exchange. Money should be a placeholder for value, where we tell each other, this is how much I value what you're doing, and I'm going to trade you these dollars or these bitcoins or whatever the case may be. I'm going to trade it to you, and I'm going to give you what I think they're worth. And if you think that, if you value what you have less than what I'm willing to pay, and if I value what you have more than I'm willing to pay, we've got to trade. That's great. That's what money should do. That's what money should be. But that's not the world we live in. We live in a world where central bankers control what money is worth. We live in a world where politicians make rules about what you can and what you can't spend your money on, where you can put your money, where you can't put your money. We live in a world where we've got all of these central banks manipulating the value of money. And so we don't have the ideal world. We don't have the free market that I wish we did. And so considering what we do have, I can see where people would say, hey, having a globalist economy is better than having all of these crazy economies. So I can sympathize with it. I don't agree with it. I think that really what the solution should be is to go the opposite way. Instead of more centralization instead of more government control and more manipulation over an economy on a global scale, I think we should go the opposite way. I think we should go back to localized. I think we should go back to the point where government has less and less control over money, that we have less centralized banking authorities. We have less points of influence where these people that are running things, that is not a that is not a racist dog whistle for the Jews again. I wish we would roll back the power that they have rather than amp up the power like a lot of these globalist corporations want to do. I think the solution is to roll back the power. Now, what are the things that we can do to accomplish that? I'm not exactly sure. People say buy local. I'm not a big fan of buying local. Like I already said, if I want to hire a virtual assistant from India or a virtual assistant from the Philippines, I'm a big fan of doing that. If I want to export work or delegate work outside of the United States, if I want to buy products from outside of the United States and sell them within the United States, as long as I'm not hurting anybody, as long as I'm not selling stuff with lead paint on them, I think I should be able to. I don't think I should have, I don't think free trade requires 3,000 page documents drawn up by mega corporate billionaires and mega millionaire politicians. I'm not a big fan of that type of free trade. I'm a big fan of actual free trade. And that's not what we get right now. And so that's my whole thing. That's my whole 2 cents on the subject. I'm not a big fan of nationalism. I'm not a big fan of globalism. I'm more of a big fan of actual free markets. And rather than move more towards a nationalist society or more towards a globalist society, I would prefer to move towards a more free market society. So that's where we're at. Donald Trump says that he's a nationalist. A lot of his fans say that they're nationalists. A lot of people on the opposite end say that they're globalists and proud to be globalists. I'm kind of stuck way out in left field where I don't want to be a nationalist or a globalist. I want to be a free market member of the free market squad, and that's what the free market squad is all about. So my name's Nathan Frazier. I hope that I brought some new thoughts to your process and made you look at things from a couple of different angles and made you maybe have a couple of aha moments throughout this episode. If that is the case, I would love to get a subscribe from you. However you're listening to this episode, whatever podcast app you use to listen to podcasts, give me a subscribe. I would appreciate it. If you enjoyed the show, also head on over to NathanFrazierShow.com. You can find more episodes over there. Until next time, Free Market Squad, faith in each other, not in authority. Be your own boss. I am Nathan Frazier, the High Priest of Propaganda, and I'm out of here. Deuces. All right, we're going to close this week's episode with a clip from Sam Harris's podcast. And this is Sam speaking with Yuval Harari. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And Yuval is somebody who advocates globalism. And rather than just me beating on about what globalists think, I'd prefer to just kind of let you listen to a globalist speak in his own point of view so that you can see how they rationalize their point of view. So without any further ado, Yuval Harari speaking with Sam Harris, and I will catch you next time.
Of increasing political and social import comes back to the issue of globalism, and that's really the political moment, the way we are beginning to see globalism become, at least in America, I guess America and in Western Europe now, it's a derogatory term, and we're witnessing a kind of collapse into nationalism and a populist attitude that claims or pretends to want nothing to do with globalism. I know you're someone who thinks that the end game for civilization is to get towards something like a world government. I'm wondering how you view the possibility of progress in that direction, given recent events in the last 12 months or so, and how you view the most likely utopian or dystopian outcomes for us in the 21st century in light of all that.
Well, there is first the question of need, and then there is the question of possibility of a global community or global identity. In terms of need, I think it's really essential, because all the major problems humankind will face in the 21st century will be global problems that simply cannot be solved on a national basis. The traditional criticism of nationalism was that nationalism leads to conflict and war and so forth. And this is still true. But I think the real objection to nationalist worldview today is that nationalism prevents us from solving the major problems, which are climate change, global inequality, the threat of nuclear war, and the threat of disruptive technologies like artificial intelligence and bioengineering. It's obvious that with climate change, no single nation can solve the problem by itself, which is why nationalists tend to just deny the problem. At first sight, it seems strange that almost all the people who deny climate change are also from the nationalist right. I mean, what's the connection? Why don't you have left-wing socialists denying climate change? But the answer, I think it's obvious that there is no nationalist answer to climate change. So as an extreme nationalist, you just have to deny the problem. But the problem is real. And unless we have a global effort, then we will face a real ecological catastrophe in the coming decades. Similarly, if you think about nuclear war, this is an old lesson that humans have learned in the last 50 or 60 years. The only way to prevent nuclear war is through global cooperation. It's not something that a single country can do by itself. Mm. And this is also true of technological disruption. If you think about the dangerous potential of bioengineering and artificial intelligence, regulation on a national basis is not going to help us. If the United States, say, regulates or decides to stop all genetic experiments on human beings, or decides not to give artificial intelligence control of weapons or something like that, it's not going to help if China or North Korea continue to do it, especially because these are high-risk, high-gain technologies, and nobody would like to stay behind. If the Chinese are doing it and they gain some crucial advantage because of that, then the US will break its own ban because it wouldn't like to stay behind. The only serious way to prevent the worst outcomes is through global regulation. So this is why I think we now need maybe not a global government, but global governance, a global cooperation. I just don't see what could be the nationalist answer to climate change or nuclear war or disruptive technology. Now, this is about the need. About the possibility, it's a different question, because humans don't always make the best decisions. Human stupidity has been one of the most powerful forces in history. It's not the only force. There is also human wisdom. I mean, sometimes humans do the right thing. If you look at, again, at nuclear weapons, so in the 1950s, many people were convinced that sooner or later, the Cold War will end in a nuclear war, which will destroy human civilization. And it didn't happen because the Americans and Soviets and Chinese and Europeans, they managed to cooperate enough to prevent this catastrophe. So there is hope. I'm not saying it's hopeless, but as I said, you should never underestimate human stupidity. At present, I think things are not so bad. I mean, they are going in a negative direction, but we are still in a far better position than, let's say, a century ago. If you remember where humankind was in 1917, then we are still in a relatively good place in terms of global cooperation. But we are on the edge of a very, very deep chasm. And the way down can be maybe very long, but you can cover it very, very fast. So I hope that humans will cooperate in their best interests. I mean, if it's every country to itself, I don't think we can solve these existential problems.
Do you think we need a story above and beyond the story you just told in your answer to this question about the necessity of global cooperation to facilitate that cooperation? Is it enough to articulate the global nature of all these problems and their imminence widely enough and credibly enough again and again? Or do we need some other kind of story to motivate people to cooperate?
I would tend to say that we need also a good story, a better story. Part of the problem with this explanation, it's too abstract, and it's very difficult to get people together unless you have an emotional enemy. You could say that climate change is an enemy and disruptive technology is an enemy, but these are very abstract enemies. Most people, you cannot motivate them. You cannot harness their emotions unless you have a more human-like enemy. This is why, in Hollywood movies, even if you make a movie about climate change, you have to have some evil person to serve as the bad guy, without which there is no movie. And I don't have a story to offer, but my guess is that we will need a powerful story to get people together.
Yes, we need those aliens from outer space to actually attack us. Quickly solve all our problems.
That could be a good story, yeah.
Well, listen, Yuval, it's really been great to talk to you. We could go on for literally hours and hours, and perhaps we'll get a chance to do it again sometime in person, because
it'd
be great.
Like to. Did you ever visit Israel by any chance?
It's been a while. I've gone there a couple of times, but it's been almost a decade, I think, since I've been there.
Well, it's changed a lot in the last decade. If you come, I will be very happy to host you here. And if not, then maybe next time and in the United States.
Wonderful. Yeah, that would be great.
Did you hear that? Of course you didn't. It was a dog whistle.